This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For reasons no one fully understands, the numbers of autistic children are rising. There's plenty of debate over whether this represents a real rise or a change in the way we diagnose autism. Later this week on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, Ira Flatow will look at the numbers, what they mean, and talk about the most recent research on the causes of autism. Today, though, another side of the autism story, how it affects the family and what it's like to live with an autistic child, brother, or sister. What type of help do families need, and what type of help is available? And what have families learned from their experience that could help other families in the same situation? If you live with someone who has autism, we want to hear your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now are Judy and Paul Karasik. Their brother David Karasik is autistic, and they've written a book about their family's experience called The Ride Together, A Brother and Sister's Memoir of Autism in the Family. Paul Karasik joins us by phone from his home in Martha's Vineyard. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Neil.
And Judy Karasik is here with us in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk the Nation.
Thanks so much.
Judy, you tell a story in the book about one day, I think it was a Saturday, you were forced to clean up your room. And realizing that your brother David didn't have to clean up his room, and you were outraged by this. So why was he special? Why didn't he have to do the same things you had to do?
Well, I was completely outraged, of course, because injustice is an issue that plagues us from a very, very early age. So I immediately consulted with my, I suppose you'd call it my lobbying group. I wanted to have my people behind me, my brother Michael, who's older than I am, and my brother Paul, who's younger. And they both were busy doing something, and they had no interest in my quest for virtue and justice and equality of treatment. And they said that you can go down and ask Mom what is different about David. So I did, and I passed by David doing one of his shows, and I got a very straight answer from my mother. She said, David gets things better, easier, because some things are harder for him. She said, the way you look at something and it's just there, or you hear a sound and it's just something you hear. She said, experience shatters before it gets to Dave, and he has to spend a lot of time putting the pieces back together. Well, that made a lot of sense to me, so I was quiet for a moment because I'd seen David putting the pieces back together, his fingers drumming against his head, and I thought, wow, you know, he's an incomprehensible pain in the neck, but he's an incomprehensible pain in the neck who needs special treatment. That seemed fair to me. So that's how that went.
Paul Karasik, something your sister just said in there, David was doing one of his shows. Tell us what that means.
Well, as you know, various people with autism have various types of fixations and skills. When you think of my brother, you could think of the character that Dustin Hoffman played in Rain Man, and you get someone in the neighborhood of being somewhat like my brother. David performs shows. Now, when I say performs, generally when we think of a performance, we think of someone in front of an audience. Well, David doesn't need an audience to do his shows. Mostly they're shows that we enjoyed as children, things like Superman and Bilko, these old comedies especially that we were fond of as kids. But he also performs these talk shows, such as Meet the Press or Face the Nation, in which he portrays the reporters, the questioners, and the various heads of state. These are not accurate sort of word-for-word recreations, but he certainly gets the gist of political discourse. And if you are in the kitchen making yourself a tuna fish sandwich, it sounds like the television's actually on, and perhaps he does make as much sense as some of these politicians.
Well, I was going to say, some of those were pretty comedic as well, if you look back at them now. But anyway, you write in this book, and Judy, you write, and Paul, you write cartoons, you draw comics, and each of you approach the same subject in your different media. But Judy, you wrote at one point, Paul mentioned the film Rain Man, and you had seen that film. Tell us about your two different experiences when you saw that
movie. Well, the first time I saw Rain Man, I just cried and cried. I couldn't control myself. I felt so sorry for the character, and I felt so sorry for David, and I suppose I felt so sorry for myself. It's a brilliant movie, and I think powerful and compassionate. I was on a road trip with David once, and we stayed at a motel. He loves motels, and I don't mind them, so we were staying at a motel. He goes to bed earlier than I do, so he was lying in the bed next to me, and the room was dark except for the television, and on came this wonderful movie that I had loved so much. But it was very different to watch it with David in the next bed asleep. And I felt very, very uncomfortable. I didn't want him to see it. I couldn't figure out why. And after thinking all kinds of thoughts that weren't the right answer, you know, that he shouldn't see somebody with autism being looked at funny. Well, that was ridiculous. He knew how people without autism looked at people with autism. I finally realized that I couldn't watch the film that I had used to make a neat package of my brother and be with my real brother at the same time, no matter how wonderful the film was.
One of the things I admire about the book is the... I guess it's the anger. I mean, you're both open about your anger. I mean, the book opens with a scene, Judy, where you're clearly angry with both of your brothers for failing, in your view, to confront the situation, staring them straight in the face. And Paul, one of the cartoon or comic strip aspects of the book, you write about the time you felt terribly embarrassed by your brother when you took him to the movies.
Well, my mother kind of forced my hand there, and I took my brother to the movies. I was always going to the movies on the weekend with my friends, and that particular weekend, my friends weren't available, and there was a Three Stooges festival, at the Revival House in town. Now, both David and I loved the Three Stooges, and pretty much for the same reasons. So she said, "Well, Paul, why don't you take David to the movies?" So I took David to the movies, but taking my brother to the movies was a mortifying experience for me in many ways. Getting through by the beautiful ticket holder who I had a crush on, and sitting in the theater, and David's talking about his shows that he's going to do when we get home and whatnot, and I'm like, "Quiet, quiet! You know, we're in a movie theater." I'm completely mortified. Of course, no one else in the theater really gave a hoot what was going on. They were there for the Three Stooges, and once the lights go down, as always happens, my favorite time in a movie theater when the lights go down, and once everyone is enwrapped by this cathartic experience of the inanity of the Three Stooges, and we really are all in the same boat together.
By the way, if you'd like to learn more about this book and the authors and read an excerpt or see some of the cartoons, visit our website at www.npr.org. Again, that's www.npr.org. If you'd like to get in our conversation here, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Let's talk with Wendy, who joins us on the line from Minneapolis.
Neil, thank you for covering this topic.
Sure.
I'm so grateful that you're covering this. We have two boys on the autism spectrum. My 7-year-old has autism and a lot of behavioral and sensory issues. And then our 4-year-old has Asperger's syndrome, which some people call the higher functioning. He's very, very bright and very, very verbal, but can be pretty rigid. The point I want to make, though, is that, you know, this is our family, and this is a... we deal with this every day, and we're fortunate to have a lot of support right now in Minnesota where we are, both through the school district and through some of the state things. We get personal care attendant help with that, although that's at risk with our budget problems, and we're very worried about that. But we are a normal family, and we do normal things, and most of the time... that works fine, but it can be difficult you know, people will comment on behaviors, you know, why is he flapping his hands or things like that. They need the same opportunities that other children get, what we need is people to really recognize is that there are a lot of families dealing with this out there, and we deal with a lot, special diets, behavior problems, but we like to do what all families do with our children.
You know, Neil, if I can say, there are a lot of memoirs out there that are about families that look ordinary on the outside, but in the inside there's lots of dysfunction. But I think most families in a situation like ours and in Wendy's, it's just the opposite. The family may look a little weird on the outside, but in fact, once you get to take a look at us, it's pretty damn ordinary.
Yes.
On the inside.
Yeah. We are fortunate that, you know, both of our boys are in good schools right now. And they get to go to birthday parties and do things like that. But we've had difficulties integrating our older child in church and church school because they were very hung up on his behaviors. It's taken 2 years of a lot of work to let him be there, you know. He had a one-on-one that he needed to go with him and to help him, and they objected to that because that wasn't part of their program to have an extra adult in there. And we had to emphasize, you know, if he needed a wheelchair, you wouldn't take the wheelchair away. He needs someone to help him navigate, you know, and they're both doing really well now, you know. And I know you're going to cover a lot of the medical things on Friday, so
yep.
I'm thrilled with that, too.
Okay, well, tune in on Friday for Ira Flatow and that.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Wendy.
Okay.
One of the things, Judy, that you write about, our household had it easy. In that there, she was just talking about the spectrum of autistic behaviors, your brother was not at the extreme end. And the other thing she was talking about is the difficulty in placement in schools, and you know the awful difficulty that a lot of people have first deciding to send somebody away or deciding they need to send somebody away, and then in your case, there was guilt over what happened when he was there.
Yeah, well, our brother was with our family through his early 20s, really. We had a couple of placements that didn't work out. It was an era in which public schools were not open as they are presently, and as Wendy says, for now. They have the supports in that they're legally mandated to have. But what happened to us was that after 15 years at a place that was state-of-the-art at the time, beautiful, out in the country, run by people that we knew and trusted. After 12 years, which I think went very well for David, and his behavior was indicated he was very happy, very bad things happened. I mean, we were a family who had every advantage. We had enough money. My parents are advocates for people with disabilities. They're tremendously well-informed. They're in the middle of the network. And still, bad things happen. People just stop being vigilant, and when they stop being vigilant, very bad things can happen very, very fast.
And you're talking about physical abuse here.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that the physical abuse comes because first there is an attitude shift, and the attitude shift is that they no longer see these people as being full human beings. They don't see past the affectations to try to understand the person behind. Wendy talks about the problems that she has integrating her children into life. I think if more people who were living with autism, not within the family but within the community, would have the courage to simply ask a few simple questions about how to communicate more effectively, they could break down a lot of barriers really very fast, and this kind of stuff wouldn't have to happen so much.
Ultimately, that's one of the reasons why we wrote The Ride Together, was so that people could meet David and could see how a family functions and see how we learn to gain acceptance of our own brother.
The book that Paul and Judy Karasik have written is called The Ride Together. If you'd like to read a little bit about it or see some of the comics that Paul has written, again, you can visit our website, which is www.npr.org. We're going to be continuing our conversation about autism and living with it, but we wanted to thank our guests. Judy Karasik, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Paul Karasik, thank you for joining us.
Neil, thanks for having us.
So we're going to continue this conversation after a break. Do you have a brother or a sister with autism, a child? How does your family handle the challenge? Our phone number again is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about living with autism. Is someone in your family autistic? Do you have a friend or a relative with an autistic child? Is your kid in a classroom with an autistic student? If so, how has that affected your life? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Adrienne Horowitz. She's Director of Family Services at the Eden 2 Programs for Autistic Children in Staten Island, New York. Eden 2 runs a school for children with autism. It has programs for autistic people of all ages. And she joins us now by phone from her office. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we go on and talk about the effects on families, can you explain a little bit to us, we were talking earlier in the program about the range of autism?
Oh, yeah, the range of autism, you know, really varies across the spectrum. We have, you know, kids here at Eden that are nonverbal, engage in severe maladaptive behaviors, you know, and then we have other individuals with autism here that can live on their own. You can have conversations with them. It really does vary, and I think that that's very confusing for both families and the community to understand that.
What's the difference between autism and Asperger's syndrome?
Well, a lot of people do consider, I think somebody else on the program had said earlier, some people consider Asperger's syndrome higher functioning autism. Typically, they don't have problems with communication skills. They do have problems with social skills, understanding the perspective of others. And, you know, sometimes they also have difficulties with mostly a lot of social skills is really where their deficits lie.
How have social attitudes about autism changed over the years? I understand in the 50s when Judy Karasik and Paul Karasik grew up with their brother David, parents used to be blamed.
Yeah, you know, Bettelheim had talked about the refrigerator mother as the cause of autism.
This is Bruno Bettelheim.
Yes. You know, where a mother that was maybe cold towards her child, didn't really show affection, was the cause of autism. These days, of course, that has really changed drastically, and they're looking into genetic components of autism.
And again, we're going to be talking more about the science of all of this on Friday, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday with Ira Flatow.
Mm-hmm.
But families, because of this, were they ashamed of autism?
In the past, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, of course, the mothers were blamed, so they had extreme guilt for that disability. And interestingly, today, even though we know that that isn't the cause, mothers sometimes still do carry guilt about what maybe they had done to cause it. In a support group that I ran a few years ago, we talked about, you know, what are some of the, you know, the worries that mothers have about maybe what caused the autism, because we don't know exactly what the cause is. Parents sometimes come up with their own beliefs as to what might have happened. So parents talk about smoking and things like that. Even though we know that that's not true, parents still do carry that, probably as a result of the information that was thought in the past to cause autism.
And again, we're all hardwired to believe in cause and effect, and there must have been something to cause this.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, Eden 2, tell us a little bit about that. How does it serve the entire family, for example?
Well, one of the things that we have here is a family services department. So in addition to servicing both preschoolers and school-age children with autism and adults with autism, we have a family services department where we offer counseling to families. We offer an after-school program, respite programs, Medicaid waiver programs, parent training programs. So we feel that this is a need for the families in addition to servicing the children. You know, there's a lot of needs that families have. We've done sibling support groups here as well.
Our telephone number again, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email, totn@npr.org. And let's go to Catherine, who's on the line with us from Newport Beach in California.
Yes, hello, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'm not exactly sure how to put all my variety of thoughts quickly into anything you'll understand, but let me start by saying that I'm the mother of twin monozygotic 7-year-old girls. Autism is more commonly thought of as being a malady of boys, and from at least my experience, boys usually have behaviors of tantruming, and both boys and girls will flap hands. My children don't do any of that type of thing. Their particular disability is primarily language deficit and an inability to give proper eye contact. And as a result of that, when I'm walking down the street with my two gorgeous, sweet little girls, we look just like any other family. But I don't treat my children the same because they need extra help. So even though they're 7 years old, I will say, for example, look at the birdie as we're going by a bird. Or, what is that? Can you say? And I sound like I'm talking to a toddler. And unfortunately, most people get the impression when they look at this that there's something wrong with me. Why is that mother treating her children like fools? And what I would really like to emphasize to your audience is that when you see a mother behaving in a strange manner, please, if you have any questions, go ahead and ask. And, you know, get a little information and understand that you're doing the best you can to help your children. And the second thing I'd like to say is you should avoid comments like, did you see on television, or I have a friend who... If I hear one more person start a conversation like that, I'm going to smack them.
In which case, they will ask about your behavior.
Believe me, you cannot have autistic children without being absolutely drowning in books to read, pamphlets to check out, television programs to watch, and radio programs to tune into. anything that's out there, you'll have already heard it. And I'm glad that the general population is being educated. I hope that people will begin to realize that not everyone who has a disability shows obvious physical manifestations of it.
I think that's an important point, because I know that often parents will get special passes to amusement parks where they're able to go in front of the line. And because their child looks typically developing, when they're going in front of the line, they often, you know, have people making a lot of comments. If the children are, engaging in tantruming behaviors in public, that also is sometimes blamed on the parent. You know, the parent, people will say things like, can't you get your child under control? What kind of parent are you?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it's a behavior of autism and not necessarily, an issue with the parent.
But is the effect, whether the parent is concerned over what people will think of their child's behavior or their behavior, is the effect to lock the family indoors?
Right. Absolutely. There are a lot of families that will not take their children out in public because of their concerns about what other people will think. We've had parents that won't tell their neighbors that their child has autism because they don't want them treated differently. So it's really difficult for families.
Well, here's an email just on that point from Lynn Jerome. This is, I have a friend, she writes, who has a 2-year-old who displays many characteristics of autism. However, no one is suggesting this to her and her husband. I'm in conflict about bringing it up, too, because it's not something parents want to hear. I'm wondering if your guest could suggest how to tell someone that their child should be screened for autism.
Well, that's rough, because I know that in speaking to a lot of parents, they were not told by professionals when taken for evaluations at first what the diagnosis was, and when they found out later on, there was resentment towards the professionals for not having said anything. So, maybe she can give her some information about autism, some reading information to see whether they think that it pertains. But, you know, early intervention really is important. And if there is anything that can be done, you want to start services as early as possible.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Diana, who's with us from Indianapolis.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am a mother of 6, and 3 of my boys are on the autistic spectrum. My youngest is 15 now. He was diagnosed autistic when he was about a year and a half, maybe 2 years old. And then my other two, my 17-year-old is Asperger's and ADHD. Then I have a 22-year-old who is... PDD and OS. I'm sure your guests know what that means. It's been hell. It's been a living hell in our house. And I took my daughter, my oldest child, to the Autism Society of America conference last summer just so she could go to the siblings workshop. And she's 23 years old, and she sat there sobbing through the whole thing because she realized that it wasn't just our family that goes through some of this stuff. But one thing I wanted to comment on was special education. We did fine with our boys in elementary school, but as they got older and as they got into middle school and high school, it became a living hell for them. And it wasn't their problem. It was the other kids' problem and how they treated them. One of my sons almost got kicked out of school because somebody was picking on him, and he turned around and he said, "I'm just going to kill you." And it wasn't an age appropriate thing for him to say, and he got really in trouble. We've just had a really hard time to the point where our youngest, now that's 15, we went ahead and put him in an alternative school where he can just go to school for half a day, get his lessons in, and come home. The social skills, I don't really want him learning what the other kids are doing right now. Hmm. And I didn't know if you had come across stuff like that in some of your other families.
Adrian?
I think that it's a conflict for families. You're talking about your child with autism that's being integrated?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when I think it's a real conflict for families. You know, on one hand, you want them integrated with typically developing peers. But on the other hand, we know that, adolescents and children can be cruel. And so it's kind of a balance between the skills that they would get in an integrated program versus are they really going to be able to develop peer relationships with those other children?
Because he's the youngest of the three, and my two oldest, when they got into high school, they just broke down. My oldest with on the spectrum, he curled up in a fetal position for a month and wouldn't get out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
We finally got him homebound and got him graduated. Now he's 22 and he's starting college and he's doing quite well. But it was hell there for a while.
Yeah,
and I just didn't want to go through that with my younger ones.
It's really rough. I mean, I do private practice counseling with high school students that are not developmentally disabled who have a difficult time fitting into high school. And
mm-hmm.
So now you're talking about somebody who sometimes has, you know, peculiar characteristics, a different way of communicating, and we would hope that people would be accepting of them, but that doesn't always happen.
Right.
Diana, can I ask, do your autistic children, do they have friends?
Not my 15-year-old. He's the one that's full-blown autism. And my oldest one that's in college is starting to develop friendships now that he's in college. His roommate, he's getting along quite well with him. My middle one, he's a little more outgoing. He's the ADHD one. He's got one or two, but it's not like, you know, typical high schoolers where they've got their own little group of friends. It's at the most one or two. But my autistic son, who's 15, doesn't have any, no.
There's also a question for families as to how much information they want to tell the school and tell the classrooms.
Right.
You know, because in one way you want the schools to be supportive, but in another way you don't want them labeled and singled out because of the disability.
Boy. Well, Diana, good luck to you, and thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Stephanie, and Stephanie's with us from Glen Allen, California.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
It's great to hear talk about, I'm the mother of an autistic daughter who's 12 and a half, and it's really great to hear parents talk about the adolescent years because that was my concern. We have, my daughter has begun puberty, and along with all of the other issues, we're dealing with the emerging sexuality issues and hormonal stuff, and that has really thrown us into a real tizzy because of all the additional changes she's going through, and I'm wondering because we haven't seen a lot out there about sexuality and adolescence and these kinds of issues, and I'm wondering if your guest has any comments about that.
I just recently did a presentation here at Eden on sexuality because it is a topic that a lot of professionals even are concerned about addressing. There is not one right way of addressing it, and I really don't think that enough research and information has been put together to guide professionals even on how to deal with these situations. And then we have parents approaching us for assistance, and it's a topic that at Eden we're still struggling with. We do not have a formal curriculum for dealing with sexuality issues, and it's something that we are aware of and that we're working towards right now.
Because one of the things that really has become clear is that this is the age where, when I was this age, I had my girlfriends to talk to and to lean on and to go through all that with. And my daughter is becoming more socially isolated than ever before. And that's just something that has been increasing. All of the other social skills that we've done, the play dates and stuff, just don't seem to be appropriate at this age.
Yeah, it's Stephanie, I think every parent dreads the coming of puberty for their children. It signals all kinds of changes. But in a way, I mean, this is how do you foresee this working out?
Well, we are pretty open in our family. We have all the we get the books out. We talk about the physiology of the body and all the changes, and that's been really good. And we try to let her know that there are times and places and people to talk about issues of your body changes with, and there are places and people not to talk about it with. And so we try to make sure we create an opportunity for her to share with us the feelings and the obsessions that are going on for her, and that she's allowed to talk about those things in her room by herself, but that they're not appropriate in school or with strangers. That sometimes works and sometimes it doesn't, and we are running into challenges at school where she will blurt things out that are just not done in middle school. And how much is behaviorally controllable and how much is possibly medically controllable is our big question now. You know, should we intervene more with hormonal stuff or other medications, or is it just something we can adapt behaviorally? And nobody really seems to know, including us.
And what about birth control?
Well, that's kind of next on our list. We're looking into that, and it's another thing. It's a whole other process to start. Right now she is on some other medications, and so it's always a tough thing, I think, for parents to know how much to do medical interventions and how much not to do, and you're always on some kind of trial. You know, at the same time, your child's body is changing, and they're processing things differently, and it's just very, very tough.
Well, Stephanie, hang in there. Good luck.
Thanks.
Appreciate your phone call. We're going to take more of your questions when we come back from a short break with Adrian Horowitz, Director of Family Services at the Eden 2 Program. 800-989-8255. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about living with autism. In a few minutes, we're going to be switching focus to talk about Libya and Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, once a pariah, now the newly elected chairman of the UN Commission on Human Rights. If you'd like to get in on that conversation, give us a phone call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. But for the moment, we're continuing with Adrian Horowitz, who's Director of Family Services of the Eden 2 Programs for Autistic Children in Staten Island, New York. And our next caller is Jeff, who's on the line with us from Hibbing, Minnesota.
Hi there. Yes, I'm a 22-year-old adult with Asperger's Syndrome. I only found this out about a year ago and doing some research for another friend. I want to talk about there seems to be a little bit of a very small amount of support services for adults with Asperger's. A lot of times they don't even get diagnosed because it's usually looked at as a childhood syndrome and what they were working on for adults with it.
How did it get caught in your case?
A friend of ours has a child who has all the symptoms of Asperger's, and so I went to the bookstore and looked up in the DSM-4 under Asperger's and, got memorized all the symptoms and everything, and it was just kind of a chance. I was thinking, boy, I'm starting to think that I fit some of these criteria. And unfortunately, the mom doesn't want to accept that her child has it. She's going on different routes of other learning disabilities. I think it's kind of a remnant of that stigma. Some people just don't want to face its autism, even if it is.
Looking back, do you think you were better off not knowing?
No, I think, you know, once I figured out that I had it, there was a sense of, you know, I'm not just a generally weird person. There's a, you know, method behind it, that this is the, that when I act certain ways and I respond to certain situations, there's a reason why, you know, there's that I'm not just an odd person, you know. So it was a bit of comforting, and it's helped me to, you know, plan out things according to that, you know, be able to cope and adapt better, I think.
So have you been able to get treatment?
There's not really any treatment. I mean, pretty much we figured at this point, you know, I've adapted as well as I can. I'm in college right now, so there's not really much they can do. I'm not going to medicate myself or anything like that, so that's about it.
That's about it. So as you look at it, I mean, you're in a peculiar position of having just realized you had it, and as you say, I mean,
right,
once you realized it, said, oh, well, that explains it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. As you look forward to the rest of your life, how are you going to change things? How are you going to change things?
Well, I've been able to find a program in school that's you know, I'm in culinary arts now, so it's a lot more routine-oriented. You know, because routines are very much more useful, and you know, you try to help yourself. If you know where your problems are, you can help cope for them. You know, if you know you've got a deficit in an area, you can plan for that, and you know, set yourself up in the best situation you can.
Hmm. Adrian Horowitz, is this common that people discover this late in life?
I haven't heard of too many cases where people discover it late in life. I think now, because the diagnosis, I mean, Asperger's is a fairly new diagnosis, so I think now people are paying more attention to it, and I'm really happy that, you know, that caller was able to identify what was going on with them, because for all of us, it's a sense of relief knowing what the, you know, what is going on for us. And I wonder if he contacted the Autism Society of America, or if he has met other adults with Asperger's.
I haven't called anybody yet about that.
Mm-hmm.
I know my little sister, my biological sister, has Asperger's,
mm-hmm.
and I've got an adopted little sister who has, they've diagnosed her as PDD, but
mm-hmm.
we really think she's more on the autism side of it. I think they're hesitant to give her the autism label.
Did you have a professional, though, actually give you the diagnosis?
Yes.
Okay.
Mental health clinic here, so.
Okay.
So, yeah, the diagnostic screening, but, and, yeah, like you said, it was only, you know, made a diagnosis here in 94, and I know when I was in school, I was homeschooled from sixth grade on, but before then, the school system was very difficult trying to get them to work with me, I remember, as a kid, so.
Hmm. Well, Jeff, thanks very much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
I wanted to read one final email that we got on this subject before we switch topics to Libya. This from Betsy, who lives in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I have an 8-year-old mildly autistic son. Thank you for doing this show. It's always good to hear autism brought into focus. Having mild autism, my son looks and usually acts mostly normally. Social skills are our biggest challenge. It's hard to go to parties and sit outside and carry a screaming child away because he just got so overwhelmed. It's hard to see my child's grandparents show preferential treatment toward my non-autistic child because she is more demonstrative. It's heart-wrenching because I know my child wants to connect and just doesn't know how to. Well, thanks very much for that email. And Adrian Horowitz, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Adrian Horowitz is Director of Family Services at the EDEN 2 programs for autistic children, and she was on the line with us from her office in Staten Island, New York.